This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we look into the story of medical professionals complicit in U.S. torture policies.
Complicit is one word. Architects of the policy is another and probably more appropriate.
Executive Director of the Center for Constitutional Rights, Vince Warren, will examine some of the government's lawless responses to the events of 9/11/2001.
9/11, used as a pretext to make war, imprison people at Guantanamo and around the world, and stifle dissent here at home.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Just about a week ago marked the 40th anniversary of the Attica uprising upstate.
Michael was involved in that and actually went up from the Center for Constitutional Rights up to Buffalo to interview prisoners who were wounded and laying around, and Michael went to talk to them about their story.
It was the first case I actually had at the center. I walked in on September 7th. Bill Kunstler's already up there by September 9th or 10th because the inmates asked him to be a negotiator for them. On September 13th, the state police and state National Guard went in and slaughtered both inmates and guards. And, of course, the stories afterwards were that they were going to kill the hostages, in fact, that they had killed the hostages and castrated the hostages. Purposely false stories were put out. My role at the center was very minor. I simply was set up there afterwards to interview people, but it was devastating. They'd been forced to run through a gauntlet, etc.
Wait, explain that.
Well, after they retook the prison, there were like, 29 killed of the prisoners, 9 or 10 guards. And then they forced the rest of the prisoners to walk over glass while the guards stood on both sides and beat the heck out of those guys and tortured them.
And that was inside the facility?
That was in the yard. They stripped them all down, had them run over glass while they were beaten. I went up after that, obviously, and into a big prison ward where people were just laying there as complete, utter messes. There's been a lot of activity around Attica on this 40th anniversary. It's significant. There was a big event up at Riverside Church. But then there was the great revelation about the conversation between Rockefeller and Nixon, that they finally got the tapes from that after Attica.
Nixon called up Rockefeller to congratulate him. And you remember, Michael, Nixon said, you could have killed 300, it would have been okay. And they're all blacks, aren't they?
Well, I think the two things that came out of that is Rockefeller said that he felt good about what he had done, although I think he got more subdued in the next call, which happened the next day when he found out that actually his own people had slaughtered guards, not just inmates. And then they also said, or Nixon, the words were, it's a black thing, right? As a way of saying, what you did here, Nelson Rockefeller, will be more acceptable because no one gives a damn about the fact that it was blacks doing it.
And then he made the point, remember, Michael and Heidi, that what you did here is really good because it's an example to the rest of the prisoners across America that they shouldn't try to rise up and change their conditions or they'll get shot down like dogs too.
I think that's a key point. And what's key about that point is it demonstrates when it came to making that point, let's suppress prison rebellions, let's send a message to prisoners all over the country, don't rise up, they were willing to take out the white working class as well as the inmates at Attica, which are the guards. They didn't care whether they killed the inmates or the guards.
Michael, you have a piece on the Nation blog this week, and you make the point that it ain't over. There's far more prisoners in prison now in America, which is really a prison house. It's the leading imprisoning country in the world. And you talk about Pelican Bay.
The piece is called From Attica to Pelican Bay. Of course, at the time of Attica, there were 250,000 prisoners or less in the United States. There's now almost 10 times the number, 2.5 million or so, 2.25. That's extraordinary. You know, the U.S. has 5% of the world's population. And guess, what percent of the
25.
Prisoners? Right, 25% of the prisoners. Heidi?
Well, as great as the atrocities at Attica were 40 years ago, I think with the increased size of the prison population now, the officials have gotten a bit shrewder, implementing practices that many people don't know about, such as protracted solitary confinement. And I'm talking about periods of 10, 20, 30 years. That's torture.
Pelican Bay is when you read Pelican Bay, you say to yourself, I couldn't stand this for a day. And yet there's people, as you're saying, Heidi, in Pelican Bay, in solitary, hundreds of them, for many years, 10, 15 years, all because they won't, quote, snitch on other gang members. So here's what you have, is you have them keeping people in prison essentially forever, but in solitary. And when you hear the descriptions of the cells, they're concrete cells completely. There's no light, natural light at all. There's a small, it's not a window, it's a couple of bars or that you can see through, and all you look through is the wall immediately outside. Minimum 22 hours a day in those tiny cells. Light on 24 hours a day. And this is going on in America right now as we speak.
That's torture, Michael and Heidi. The human personality disintegrates when people are kept alone. People are social. And when they're kept alone with the lights on in a cement cell forever, they're just destroyed. And that's what this country is doing.
What was the status of the lawsuits coming out of Attica? I know that as recently as 10 years ago, I think there was a final settlement in some of the cases.
There's three lawsuits. There's many lawsuits that were brought by various National Lawyers Guild members in particular. Michael Deutsch, who we've interviewed on Chicago, brought an important one to stop this gauntlet-type stuff. I brought one to try and compel the Center for Constitutional Rights. I brought one to try and compel prosecutions of the guards because they were only prosecuting the inmates. Ultimately, I lost the lawsuit, but ultimately we won the point that they, at least part of the point, every single one of the prosecutions against the inmates was dismissed or amnestied by the governor because of a report that said you have to look at what happened here with the guards. And rather than do that, they got rid of all the prosecutions against the inmates. So that's the second lawsuit. And the third one, which is, of course, the big one for compensation, was Liz Fink, the National Lawyers Guild, and a team of lawyers who eventually settled after 27 years of litigation, settled for the torture and the murders that happened for over $12 million. Not a huge amount considering the numbers and considering the struggle that Liz and others went through, but at least a measure, some measure of compensation for the people and of certainly of historical correcting of the record.
Michael and Michael, the center has a lawsuit against the Catholic Church. What is the update on that?
The center brought an absolutely crucial case against the Vatican, but particularly against the Pope and three of his aides at the Vatican, and they're bringing it to the International Criminal Court.
The Center for Constitutional Rights is representing victims of sexual abuse, and they're suing the Pope?
Well, here's why. We represent actually a group called SNAP, and we've interviewed SNAP on this radio show, a group of survivors of abuse by the priests. We've interviewed them on this show before. They alone have 10,000 members in SNAP of people who've been abused. They estimate that it's 100,000 people in the United States who've been abused by priests. 6,000 priests in the United States alone have been accused of abuse. It's probably 100,000 more worldwide of priests. Well, what the center did is go to the International Criminal Court, and here's why. There's lots of individual cases against priests for compensation, against the Archdiocese of Boston, against the Archdiocese, I think, of Milwaukee, against, you know, various ones, Los Angeles, big settlements coming down, etc. And the Catholic Church, particularly the Vatican, has always said, well, it's not our fault. We didn't do anything here. It's the local diocese or it's the local priests and all this.
Blame it on the bishops.
Right. But in fact, if you look at the history of it, it's been right at the heart of the Vatican. Ratzinger, who is now the Pope, was head of the Committee for the Propagation of the Faith.
That's the Inquisition.
Right. That's the office of the Inquisition. So he basically has been setting the rules for this along with some others. And what our lawsuit charges is two things, really. One is that they have allowed this to flourish and tolerated it by, rather than telling people they have to report these crimes to the police, rather than telling them that, they simply move the priests around to another place. They don't have the crimes reported. So they've actually let it continue to flourish and happen. And the second thing we've charged is that's called command responsibility. And the second is simply not doing anything about it when it happens. Really similar. And we call them crimes against humanity. And crimes against humanity are mass attacks or mass crimes against a civilian population. And the crimes here are torture, rape, abuse, etc. Whether the International Criminal Court will take jurisdiction of this is hard to say. But what it's done is, the major thing to me it's done is, it's really trying to put responsibility where it belongs, which is right on the shoulders of Ratzinger, the Pope, and the Vatican. Right on their shoulders. And it's also working in the lead with a group called SNAP, who's taking the lead on this. I was at a press conference last week in front of St. Patrick's, the biggest Catholic cathedral in New York City. And there you saw victims holding up themselves as pictures they had as small children when they were abused. And I'll tell you, there wasn't a dry eye. There were tears. These people are in their 40s, 30s, 20s right now, and they were just broken down from this abuse. This is serious, and it's putting the blame where it belongs, on the shoulders of the Vatican.
Michael, procedurally, where does the case stand?
Well, we've written a long complaint to the International Criminal Court, which we filed. If you go on the Center for Constitutional Rights website, ccr.org, you can see that complaint. You can also, I think, have access to 10,000 pages of documents that we filed with the International Criminal Court. So now it's up to the criminal court.
Are those pages testimony from victims?
Yes, they're testimony of victims and of the grand juries and of the failure of the Vatican to go after these cases. And what we're waiting for now, the next step, is for the International Criminal Court to decide whether or not to begin an investigation. I think they're almost obligated to.
If, to your knowledge, has the Pope ever been sued before?
Well, people have maybe attempted to sue the Pope before, but in domestic courts, he has an immunity, whereas for crimes against humanity in the International Criminal Court, there is no immunity for a head of state, assuming you buy the fiction that the Pope is a head of state.
Michael, there's no other organization in the world that would have done what the Center for Constitutional Rights did here. Every success, CCR.
One of the things we're doing is we're going on a 12-city tour in Europe with SNAP and with some of the survivors. And in each of those cities, they're going to have both public meetings and private meetings with other people who we hope this will give the courage to come out and meet with SNAP and work with SNAP on bringing this to justice. In a place like Spain, for example, where there's an incredibly repressive Catholic Church and very few survivors are willing to come forward, we're going into Madrid, we're having private meetings with survivors, and we're going to go forward in country by country to try and give this the worldwide attention that it deserves.
Some astonishing new figures on the state of poverty in this country.
We've brought you updates on the economics of the Obama administration in the world from time to time. But as Malcolm said, chickens are coming home to roost. The highest level of poverty, I think, recorded almost since they
started keeping records.
Right. It's 15.1% of the population of the United States is living below the poverty level, a poverty level already set very low.
How low is that?
It's $24,000 for a family of four, but half of the people living in the poverty level make only $12,000 a year for a family of four.
So 15.1%, one out of 6.5 people is living in poverty.
And to conclude, although one out of six people live in poverty, in terms of children, it's even higher. As many listeners know, health professionals were complicit in the U.S. policies of torture. The torturers relied heavily on medical opinion. Medical professionals provided sanitizing and rationalizations for the infamous torture memos. During waterboarding procedures, a doctor would be present. Psychologists were directly involved in the supervision, design, and execution of torture at U.S. military and intelligence facilities. This is a violation of both state law and professional ethics. These health professionals that were involved with torture still hold their professional licenses to practice. Meanwhile, a legal battle continues against the Louisiana Psychology Board for refusing to investigate professional misconduct allegations against Dr. Larry James. He's a retired U.S. Army colonel and high-ranking advisor on the interrogations for the U.S. military at Guantanamo. We talk more about this case and the breach of ethics in the medical profession since 9/11 with Dr. Stephen Saltz, former president of Psychologists for Social Responsibility. Stephen is a psychologist, psychoanalyst, and public health researcher in Boston. He's also a co-author of Physicians for Human Rights Report on Experiments in Torture. Welcome, Dr. Saltz, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Stephen, you're a psychologist, past president of the Psychologists for Social Responsibility. And I know you've been following and very involved in opposing a lot of the APA's
practices or their authorizations for certain practices, ethical practices around Guantanamo, abuse, torture, etc. But I want you to go back a little bit and give us some sense. First of all, psychologists played a role of some sort, which you can describe for us, at Guantanamo and in other places. And can you just give our audience a sense of what that was?
Well, they played a central role. There were actually two professions that were central. One was lawyers, and we've heard a lot about how they provided rationalizations for torture. The other, which is less well known, is psychologists. And it turns out that it was psychologists who designed and implemented the enhanced interrogation torture program, who monitored it, who trained others in it, and who researched it and provided also the legal protection that the lawyers had arranged for, which required psychologists and other health professionals' involvement. So psychologists were central there. So when we hear about the torture, say waterboarding of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed or Abu Zubaydah, it's believed that it was psychologist James Mitchell who was present there, who was in charge.
Can you describe a little bit what those kinds of abuses were and a little more about the actual role of some of those psychologists?
Okay. And you have to, it's sort of complicated because the U.S. experience with torture and the war on terror has many different parts to it, and they get confused a bit. There's the CIA program, which was for so-called high-value detainees in CIA custody and various secret prisons called black sites around the world. This is where the psychologists were absolutely central, where they designed and the whole thing. There was evidently a black site at Guantanamo where a few people were held at various points, but Guantanamo was technically under the military's control, not CIA control, and what was done there was a little bit different. So first with the CIA, you know, as I said, the psychologists designed this stuff, which was quite brutal. It involved things like forcing people to stand, shackling them up with their arms out, naked in cold air for, say, 7 days at a time. I think the lawyers said a maximum of 10 days. This was called sleep deprivation, but of course, being forced to stand for day after day is not just sleep deprivation. It's also extraordinarily painful. Just try standing for an hour or two without moving. Think about forcing you that for days on end without use of a toilet, with liquid food being forced into you. They, in some cases, use small boxes where a person could neither stand nor sit. They would crouch in very painful positions while the airflow was partially restricted. The boxes were banged on. At times, they would throw people against walls with special devices around their neck, supposedly to protect them from permanent damage. There were various slaps that were authorized. And so this was, as I say, was designed by these psychologists, was authorized in the White House.
By who?
By a group called the Principals Group, which included Vice President Cheney, Colin Powell, Alberto Gonzalez, Attorney General, the National Security Advisor, Condi Rice, and several other, Donald Rumsfeld, head of the Department of Defense, the George Tenet of the CIA. CBS News reported that these people met and authorized the various techniques in the White House. President Bush admitted it and said that he agreed with them. So there's no question at this point. Supposedly, these techniques were demonstrated to the principals group by CIA officials so that they would know what they were talking about.
So, Steve, we have that on the one hand, and then we have, at least at one point, you being a member of, I guess it's the, what I would refer to loosely as the trade organization for psychologists, the American Psychological Association, that supposedly governs in some way psychologists and what the ethics of what they do are, and you have to describe what it is, but... And there became some controversy around the involvement of psychologists in the Guantanamo secret site abuse and torture. Describe what it was, and then we'll lead you where we are today.
Yeah, well, the APA is primarily involved at the ethical level. So the APA has an ethics code that is binding on all members. Not all psychologists are members, but all the states base their own ethics code for licensed psychologists upon that of the APA. Some mandate it exactly, some basically adopt their own based on it. So the APA ethics code is also the basis for all licensed psychologists in the country. Now, the military and CIA insist that their psychologists who do this stuff and other things be licensed by the states. Many of them are APA members. So the APA ethics are intimately involved here. When in 2004, the press reported that psychologists at Guantanamo on so-called biscuit teams, behavioral science consultation teams, would be referred to as biscuits based on the acronym, were using material in detainees' medical records to design ways to break them down. So if someone had a phobia of insects, you might put them in an environment with insects, etc. And this is grossly unethical by any standard of the health professions. You know, the APA ethics code has a principle A, which says psychologists strive to benefit those with whom they work and to do no harm. So it seemed to many that this was, you know, patently unethical. The APA, however, equivocated. They formed in 2005 a task force, the so-called PENS task force, Psychological Ethics and National Security, which said that it was ethical for psychologists. In fact, psychologists had an obligation to keep interrogations safe, legal, ethical, and effective. This language, it turns out, was taken from the torture memos of the Bush Justice Department, just almost verbatim, but that wasn't known at the time. What turned out was that task force was dominated by a majority of people from the military intelligence community, a number of whom, four of whom, had served in chains of command that had been implicated in abuses. So they appointed people who were served in chains of command involved in abuses. And I use that carefully because I can't prove what any individual did. But certainly it's very questionable. You know, the biscuits, two of them were involved with the biscuits at Guantanamo, for example, who had been accused of committing these abuses by the Red Cross. That's who the APA chose to formulate its policy. They then kept the membership secret for a year till it was leaked to the press, and then they denied ever keeping it secret. So they decided that to try and justify this, to provide an ethical basis. It turns out that they also changed the ethics code in 2002. As the code was being changed, they inserted several clauses that made it easier for people to participate in these kinds of activities.
How do they justify doing the kind of things you described in torturing people? What's the justification?
Well, they don't. They claim to be resolutely against torture. They make statement after statement, like the Bush administration. Remember, the Bush administration, until recent times with Dick Cheney, the Bush administration was always against torture. You know, President Bush would say, you know, we do not torture. Donald Rumsfeld was outraged at what happened in Abu Ghraib, even though he authorized it, you know? So the same with the APA. They're against torture. They've issued statement and statement against torture. And so they claim that psychologists are safety officers, that they keep interrogation safe by keeping people from going over the line into torture. But it turns out that this is exactly the reasoning that was built into the torture memos of the Bush Justice Department, that health professionals, psychologists, and physicians would be safety officers that would say, as long as they said something wasn't torture, wouldn't cause long-lasting harm in the Bush definition of torture, as long as something wouldn't cause long-lasting harm, then it didn't matter what harm it actually caused because health professionals said it wouldn't. So it was okay.
So what do you think of that argument, Steve?
I think it's absurd for several reasons. One, psychologists have absolutely no training in being safety officers. We know nothing about it. If you want someone to be a safety officer, you should have an attorney, one of the JAGs, for example, who know the law, who are used to that kind of issue. That's not what we know anything about. Two, it mixes up the role because psychologists were aiding interrogations, suggesting approaches to break people down at the same time they're supposed to stop them from going too far. Three, psychologists and other health professionals are in this special role in the military in that, you know, they're considered to be a bit of a wimp. And so, therefore, there's great pressure on them to show that they're tough. So they're the last people you would expect to cry stop, you know, because the situational pressures are so great. And in general, in a classified setting, the situational pressures are very great, and you can't rely upon individuals to stop abuses. So even if you had well-meaning people, it was absurd. But there's absolutely no evidence that in the military or the CIA that that role was particularly well-meaning. It was designed as a legal protection, not as a real ethical and health protection.
We're speaking with Stephen Soles, who is the director, Center for Research, Evaluation, and Program Development at the Boston Graduate School of Psychoanalysis. Now, Stephen, you mentioned that the APA, essentially, their rules are what sets the standards for licensing in states throughout the United States. Over the last few years, there have been a number of complaints against psychologists who participated in these abuse and torture programs. There was one recently, I think, in Ohio, one in Texas, maybe one in New York. Are you familiar with that, and can you bring us up to date?
We believe, but it needs to be proven.
Right.
And so my various colleagues have filed complaints, in some cases with the APA, which has refused various complaints, and in other cases has had an open complaint against one psychologist, John Lesso, who served at Guantanamo. Since 2006, August of 2006, we're going on 5 years, they've been unable to do anything with it. It's still open, as far as I know. Then when APA was clearly not doing anything, colleagues moved and filed complaints in those states and actually some other states as well. And in every case, the licensing boards dismissed the complaints. In several states, in New York and Ohio, they refused to even examine it whatsoever, conduct any examination. In Ohio, they gave no excuse for not doing so. In New York, it's very interesting. The licensing board took the rather odd position that since psychology is supposed to help people, if Dr. Lesso used his techniques to help break somebody down, this wasn't psychology, so they had no jurisdiction over it. In other words, if I as a psychologist decide I'm going to try and use my skills to destroy somebody, that's fine with them because that's not psychology. It's bizarre, and it's actually frightening legal precedent. In Texas, the complaint is against James Mitchell, the premier CIA torture psychologist. The board there evidently did a perfunctory examination and dismissed the complaint. So in all three states, attorneys have joined my colleagues in filing suits trying to force the board to do their job, to claim that it's just not okay. The board doesn't have the leeway to just dismiss claims of torture without clearly investigating them, that these are clear ethical violations and they need to be investigated to find out if these individuals actually committed these offenses.
So far, we haven't seen them do that yet. Let's hope they do.
No, so far, every court has thrown them out in various appeals.
There was recently, and I saw it circulated on the listserv that you and I are on together, about Larry James getting some kind of award from the American Psychological Association, I think. I'm not sure. I think that's who it was.
The award is. Okay. Last month, down in D.C. at the convention, they gave the Society for Military Psychology's Robert S. Nichols Psychology Award for outstanding service and committed to the military practice of psychology and the extended military community. They gave Larry James this award.
So who's Larry James? What do you think of that award?
Well, Larry James was a biscuit at Guantanamo. He followed John Lesso that I mentioned in early 2003. He later served at Abu Ghraib after the scandals there. He claims to have been the person who cleaned it up. But he's written a book on his experiences at Guantanamo where, you know, he essentially admits offenses. He doesn't admit that he abused people, but he admits the observed abuse by other interrogators and did not report it to the commanders, which is an offense in the military. And he also describes in detail the lives, the personal experiences of several young 14-year-olds who were held at Guantanamo, who he allegedly was in charge of the treatment of. These are known people. Their names are public. So he's violated the confidentiality reports that they were raped, for example. This is a gross ethical violation. He, as the lead biscuit, we suspect he was involved in even more offenses there. He's now out of the military, is the dean of the School of Psychology at Wright State University in Ohio. So there's been ethics complaints filed against him in several states. The APA refused to open a complaint. So instead, the APA has showered awards upon him. This is only the latest of many that he's been given by a number of divisions, the counseling psychology division, things. He's sort of an insider in the APA, so they protect their own. It's rather sad. Rather than say we should investigate this and find out what did or did not happen, they just say they attack those who raise issues about Colonel James. It's also sad that the military psychology division, they elected him president. I suspect that there are many in that division who are not happy with the role of a relatively small number of psychologists and the biscuit teams and others. And so it's rather sad that they took this step.
You said earlier that you quit the American Psychological Association. Why'd you quit?
Well, a number of us did. It used to be that you could not pay your dues and remain a member for 2 years. And we launched a protest movement, withhold APA dues, to protest their position on these issues. When those 2 years were up, I couldn't see paying my dues until the policy changed and until the people on the staff who had promoted this policy were gone. I refused to pay the salaries of the people who, in my view, colluded with the Bush administration torture program.
Steve Soltz, we really want to thank you for being with us. We've been speaking with Stephen Soltz, Director of Center for Research, Evaluation, and Program Development, Boston Graduate School of Psychoanalysis, and former past president of the Psychologists for Social Responsibility. I want to really thank you, Steve, as someone who's been following for many years your work on our torture listserv and others. You've been at the forefront of really opposing what the APA is doing and what the psychologists have been doing at Guantanamo and around the world. So thank you, Stephen.
Thanks for being on Law and Disorder.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Years now since the 9/11 attacks. Much has changed for the United States and for what the United States has done around the world. We're in a state of permanent war, wars everywhere, a state of depredations of fundamental rights from Guantanamo to rendition to torture. And here at home, domestic surveillance is the order of the day. You're not safe in your car, in your place of worship, or on the street. Today, to talk about the 10 years, is the Executive Director of the Center for Constitutional Rights, Vince Warren. The center has been in the forefront of fighting these violations of rights, these wars, and this surveillance. Vince Warren joins us today to talk about the last 10 years, but hopefully not the next 10 years.
Vince Warren, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks very much for having me.
We are having you back on as a guest to mark, unbelievably, the 10th anniversary of the events of September 11. And you have been doing a lot of speaking on really sort of the most crucial takeaways that we need to consider at this point. Starting with issues related to war, how would you describe the most pressing issues?
You know, Heidi, this has really been one of the most drastic declines in our democracy, certainly since the Japanese internment and the Red Scares in the 1950s. And one way to think about this is to think about how many wars were we in prior to 9/11, and how many wars are we in now, and what opportunity have we as people that live in this country had to influence the war-making that's been happening. Prior to 9/11, there was a lot of discussion about Iraq. And after 9/11 and after George Bush really seized power and steamrolled over Congress and declared unilateral war, that was something that, while it was not unusual in the context of what presidents think about the War Powers Resolution, I think the breadth, the scope, and frankly the basic lies that went into trying to convince the U.S. public that this was something to do has been phenomenal. So now we're in a situation where we are essentially in five wars. We are bombing in all manner of countries. We are bombing in Pakistan. We're bombing in Yemen. We've bombed in Libya. We're in the east, in the Horn of Africa, in addition to Iraq and Afghanistan. The piece here is, for the last 10 years, what did we as the people in this country, who are supposedly the ones who help determine how these policies are going to be enacted, what role did we were we able to play in order to denounce this, in order to stop this? What emerges from the last 10 years is that the war paradigm, the concept that we are at war in order to make war, is something that the American public has largely bought into. And as a result, we've ceded a great deal of power with respect to how we circumscribe this president or presidents moving forward.
Yeah, so Vince, what, explain a little bit, what does it mean at war to make war?
Well, when right after September 11th, the Bush administration started issuing secret executive orders, and they issued authorization for use of military force. And the rhetoric that they used was that this was a war on terror. The United States is at war as a result of the falling of the Twin Towers, that we went into a war mode, both domestically and internationally. And I think the significance of that has been all of the civil liberties, all of the rule of law, all of the traditional ways that we had been dealing with these types of problems went out the window. By using the war paradigm, the president essentially seized power that belonged to Congress, seized power that belonged to the courts, and seized power that belonged to the people. And so the concept is that since the United States was declared to be at war with Al-Qaeda or at war with terrorism, it was essentially an excuse to make war in some of these other countries. Because, of course, we were not at war with any of these places during the time that this thing started. And, of course, you can't be at war with a concept like terrorism, which is essentially a criminal context. So prior to September 11th, when terrorist activity would happen, the normal course was investigation, indictment, prosecution, and if there was a case there to be convicted. And we've thrown that out the window. Here's an example. Prior to September 11th, when people were captured on the battlefield, they were governed by the Geneva Conventions. George Bush threw that out the window and said that those conventions didn't apply. When people were brought to the United States for alleged attacks on U.S. citizens, on U.S. properties, on the United States itself, they were brought to federal courts. Now, in 2011 will be the 224th anniversary of the Constitution, it is a crapshoot as to whether anybody's going to go into federal court whatsoever. In fact, more people in Guantanamo have died in Guantanamo than have been referred for criminal charges in a court. And that's just outrageous. I think that really sums up what's been happening over the last 10 years.
Vince, some posit that the Republicans and others had actually this agenda in place years before the events of 9/11, but that the attacks offered the opportunity really to help us sort of forge ahead in building empire. The tragedy was exploited to enable that agenda to move forward.
Well, I think that's definitely the case. We shouldn't fool ourselves into thinking that this was a legitimate reaction to a tragic event and, you know, a generally terrifying event like terrorism. This is something that had been in place for a very long time, that there have been oil interests and other regional interests that have been at play, which define precisely how, when, and with what force we use preemptive war as a, almost like a foreign policy negotiating tool. And this was really, the 9/11 attacks were definitely excused. That was the key moment, that was the key defining moment in which people began to operationalize what we see now. And, you know, there's an analogy, it's a loose analogy to Hurricane Katrina, which is that if you think that after Hurricane Katrina, which happened 6 years ago, that they decided to move into the privatization of schools and privatization and the breaking down of unions and moving poor people out and moving rich people in and developing New Orleans simply because there was a hurricane, you're very naive. That was something that was in play prior to that disaster as well, just like the move towards building empire had been in play, and it was really just waiting for an opportunity in the context of 9/11.
Vince, would you conclude then that the ultimate crime, war of aggression, the crime that the United States tried the Nazis for in Nuremberg, would you say that that was also what happened in Iraq?
Oh, absolutely. There are a couple of key elements here. This aggressive war that happens that is based on lies, that's not based on any legitimate military or national security threat, is a crime. And the other piece that we see in the 10 years since 9/11 has been this interesting doublespeak, that things that we all knew were crimes prior to 9/11, certainly with respect to international law, things like torture, things like aggressive war, all of a sudden become justifications for national security since 9/11, and that we're having debates for some strange reason in this country, whether the president should have to go to Congress in order to declare war, whether there needs to be a legitimate threat in order for troops to be able to be deployed, whether torture is a legitimate means by which we can get information from people we capture. The whole thing has been turned on its head. And I think to answer your question, Michael, absolutely, that there have been serious and in fact some of the most serious crimes known to international law committed in the last 10 years, and simply no one has been held accountable thus far.
And I know, Vince, you've been talking a lot about war, and it is extraordinary how many wars we're in right now. And you mentioned some of the sort of Guantanamo-related issues. Can you just talk about those for another moment, and then we'll move to some more domestic stuff?
Sure. President Obama talked very big in his first couple of months of office about ending torture and ending these policies. One thing that he didn't talk about, and what we saw, particularly in our cases, was that the administration in court, as they were saying these things in public, were taking precisely and continue to take precisely the same position that the Bush administration took with respect to the ability of the government to detain people outside of the legal process. We see two examples of this. Number one, President Obama created at Guantanamo a category of people who he has no intention of trying, and he intends to keep at Guantanamo until he doesn't feel like keeping them there anymore. He puts a bow around it, but it's the exact same policy with respect to George Bush, except he talks a little bit better. Another way that we see this is when there was recently someone that was captured on the Horn of Africa, and instead of sending this man to federal court to be prosecuted and even sending him to a place like Guantanamo, where now the courts have scrutiny over the conditions there, thanks to the Center for Constitutional Rights and other groups, he decided to hold this guy on a boat for 3 months in the middle of the international waters to interrogate this person. That is shocking. It is shocking. And what's even more shocking is that that's the type of maneuvering that we've gotten used to in this country, rather than having charges filed against somebody and someone having their day in court and let the chips fall where they may in terms of the evidence.
Vince, shocking too is the lay of the land now, 10 years later, after 9/11, with respect to domestic repression. The police spy apparatus working with the federal government, the clampdown and demonstrations. Talk to us about that.
Terrorism is a word that's been used repeatedly by the executive. And I think most people, when those words were used to think about it as international terrorists, people outside of the country. But what we find, and this is, of course, nothing new in U.S. history, this mantra, this fear-mongering phrase, is actually being used to clamp down on a very vibrant and growing movement of people who are political activists, people who are, in fact, protesting the very policies by which the government is employing the repression. It's a little bit ironic. And so what you see is that all across the country, including the FBI raids, including the collusion with state governments and contractors and federal officials in terms of spying on groups, you see this around the country, that what is happening now is that the United States, local police forces, immigration forces, private contractors are colluding and conspiring to infiltrate political movements, and largely peaceful political movements, in fact, and solidarity movements, in order to you know, uproot the terrorists, the quote-unquote terrorists. Now, of course, there are no terrorists there. What there are people who have a very vibrant and a very credible claim to the fact that what the government is doing, has been doing, and likely will do, is grossly illegal. It is breathtakingly illegal what the government is doing, and the people who are the most likely to protest that, including the longtime solidarity activists, Palestine solidarity activists, and including relatively new players like the digital whistleblowers, like the anonymous people, the WikiLeaks people, these folks are all coming under the thumb, under the mantra of terrorism, under the greatest repressive power that the U.S. government can now muster. And this is going to be the challenge moving forward over the next 10 years. This is where the battle is going to be in order to reclaim our democracy.
One problem with this, Vince, is that the government is making available large pots of money, you know, for different states and different law enforcement agencies to identify terrorist threats. So it's sort of a self-perpetuating problem in that if a little town or a municipality wants to get some money for its law enforcement, they have to put people on the terrorist watch list. And
well, that's exactly right. And that is one of the oldest tactics in the book, that the government uses its spending power to enforce policies that are completely devoid from what the goal of those policies are. And you remember back, and you can think about it even prior to September 11th, when you were looking at Tulia, Texas, where you had all of this law enforcement money that was going towards, under the war on drugs, to secret informants and different types of things like that. They rounded up a whole town falsely under drug charges. Well, they did the same thing after September 11th. They rounded up practically an entire community of South Asian, Arab, and Muslim folks here in the United States using police, state police power, local police power, and federal immigration power to round people up. Now, they did not suspect these people of being terrorists, but they were detaining them to be able to isolate them and to figure out where the terrorists were. And I think that's how that type of policy ends up working. If you put money in front of people and say, go find the terrorists, they will round everybody up and essentially shake them down to see if they can find the terrorists because they're following the money. And that's what we see happening here in the United States in terms of infiltration of mosques, of using confidential informants and snitches in order to get prosecutors, you know, some good convictions and some good trials like we were seeing up in upstate New York. It's really outrageous.
Vince, I want to bring you back to when Obama first took office. I know you had a early meeting with Obama with some other human rights groups. And, you know, we were all pretty optimistic. He promised to close Guantanamo, promised some things about military commissions, made some promises about torture. And to the extent you feel comfortable, if you can talk about what happened in that meeting and how you felt as a result.
Yeah. Myself and a number of other human rights and civil rights organizations went to a meeting with President Obama in May of 2009. And at first, I thought, well, this is very encouraging that they would invite the Center for Constitutional Rights, who had been one of the major thorns in the government's side on this issue, to the table to discuss issues. Well, when we got there, we put a number of issues on the table that we wanted him to do something about. One, of course, was closing Guantanamo. Here we are almost 2 years later, and we're no closer to that than we were back then. Another issue was with respect to torture and rendition and to military commissions, trying people in federal courts instead of these fake military commissions. Coming out of that meeting, you know, that meeting happened the day before his speech in the National Archives in front of the U.S. Constitution, where he announced five categories of detainees in Guantanamo. One thing that, coming out of that meeting, I was shocked, and I don't use that word a lot, but I was very shocked at how I thought that President Obama completely understood the legal issues that we were raising. I think he completely understood the moral issues that we were raising, and I think he understood that what we were raising was consistent with what he had been saying on the campaign trail. But the very next day, he came out with essentially a preventive detention scheme, indefinite detention scheme in Guantanamo, and has now proceeded to house and to initiate one of the largest crackdowns on whistleblowers in U.S. history. So disappointed is definitely a word that I felt. I expected better of him. And what really troubled me is that he knows. He knows precisely what the right thing to do is. He either lacks the political courage or lacks lacks the political power to be able to move those things forward. But again, what we need is a visionary. And I've always said that I think one of the hallmarks of the Obama presidency is going to be that he negotiates from the middle. And so you're going to end up with something that is somewhat right of center on just about every issue that he moves forward on. So it's not a huge surprise, but it was deeply disappointing because I thought that was our last great chance to be able to make sweeping changes to restore the Constitution in the same way that George Bush made sweeping changes to shred it to begin with 10 years earlier.
Vince, I know that we share a mutual hero, and that's Arthur Kinoy, who died a few years ago, the consummate people's lawyer. What do you think Arthur would say right now, were he with us?
I'm not going to do the Arthur impersonation, although I'm tempted to do it, but he would say that this is the greatest constitutional crisis in American history. Arthur argued U.S. versus U.S. District Court, I think it was in 1972, I think that was the case, which argued that the U.S. government could not wiretap its citizens, even under a national security rationale, without a warrant. And the Supreme Court agreed with that, and that was 30-some-odd years ago. Here we are 30 years later, and the U.S. Supreme Court would likely come up with the exact opposite answer. Maybe they wouldn't, but we've never been able to get any of these cases into court because of standing issues. And I think Arthur's view would be, number one, that history is repeating itself. And for those of us who witnessed it, we need to get back out in the streets and get back and protest and get back and fight back. And for those of us who are too young to have witnessed it, we need to get on the bandwagon because this thing is not going to fix itself. Arthur would always talk to the students at Rutgers Law School about that there were really four branches of government. There was the executive, the judiciary, the legislative branch, and then the fourth branch was the people. What Arthur would see is what we're seeing now, is that the fourth branch, the people, have been completely disenfranchised from a constitutional and a separation of powers perspective from influencing our own freedoms, influencing the elected officials that we have, influencing the non-elected officials that we have. We've lost the power to be able to define the course of the country that we live in.
Vince, I too was a great admirer of Arthur. Politically, Arthur, of course, was not a supporter of the Democratic Party. Until his dying day, he said that fourth branch of government, the American people, should have its own party, and the Democrats weren't one of them. And I'm afraid, though, that coming up, we're going to have Rick Perry against Obama, and people are going to fold and say, well, Rick Perry's even worse, so support Obama. So I think, you know, we should have listened to Arthur yesterday and tried to organize ourselves in that fourth branch of government. But let me ask you a question to switch back to domestic. Talk to us about the Republican National Convention. What happened in New York? What happened in Pittsburgh? How is it for people that want to demonstrate and exercise their First Amendment rights now? What's it like now as compared to 10 years ago?
And don't you have an introduction to an important new book that the Center for Constitutional Rights has published called Hell No, Your Right to Dissent in 21st Century America? And Vince Warren wrote a really wonderful introduction. I recommend it.
So do I.
It's a wonderful book. It was written by Michael Ratner and Margie Ratner Kunstler. In that book, there are a couple of pieces that I think it's a good way to talk about it. In that book, there are a number of pieces that I think are really significant for organizing and activists in the 21st century. Number one, the book goes through and talks about the history of struggle and really talks about dissent. Not necessarily just plain free speech and not necessarily expressing your opinion, but actual political dissent as a First Amendment paradigm that is the first to get crushed when it comes to government repression. And this is what we're seeing absolutely right now across the country. And I think there have been some very interesting changes in the last 10 years that the government has actually adapted to very well. Number one, people used to organize through meetings and through discussion. Now people organize digitally. You can reach a lot more people and get the message out. You don't have to get everybody in the same room in order to plan an action. And because these things are happening digitally, that the government is now cracking down on digital communications. And they're doing it in a subtle way in terms of obviously monitoring the internet and monitoring cell phone accounts and Twitter accounts and different things like that. But they're also doing these pre-raids. When they infiltrate the movements, they infiltrate folks, that they'll go and they'll send the agent provocateurs in, and they will ramp things up. And then, of course, they'll come in prior to an action and seize all of the cameras, all of the cell phones, all of the computers in order to build a case prior to anybody even demonstrating. This is the definition of chilling of of First Amendment speech. The other way that things are happening, which I mentioned earlier, is that whistleblowers blow whistles in different ways now than they did 10 years ago. It's not about the file that you have in your desk drawer and then you take it home. This is about who has the data set. And the data set and being able to release the data set of government misdoings to millions and millions of people around the world simultaneously creates a huge problem for the government that's trying to cover up its wrongdoing. So they have taken broader strokes in terms of cracking down on that, as we've seen with Julian Assange and as we've seen with Anonymous. And I should also point out that the National Lawyers Guild has an excellent website with respect to whistleblowers and Anonymous, and people listening to this should definitely check that out because it's an extraordinary step. And the National Lawyers Guild and the Center for Constitutional Rights recognize that dissent in the United States is gravely under attack. And if we don't take immediate steps, which of course means more dissent, we will give up the very rights that we have to be able to resist what the government that's doing is wrong, and we'll give up the rights to be able to influence the government to do the things that we want it to do.
Well, thank you, Vince. And I know Heidi's sitting here, and she was one of the people responsible for the wonderful Guild Anonymous support website. Thanks for mentioning it. We've been speaking with Vince Warren, Executive Director of the Center for Constitutional Rights, really the preeminent institution that's been taking on post 9/11 depredations of liberty throughout the world. For people to get more information about the center, and if you can point them to not just the website, but anything specific you'd like them to look at.
Yeah, there are a couple of things. The website is ccrjustice.org. We post a tremendous amount of information on Facebook, so definitely friend the Center for Constitutional Rights on Facebook. We have a Twitter feed, which is at the CCR, where a lot of our information is out there. We're going to be having a number of events that are coming up this month with respect to 9/11. So you should check our website because all of the events are listed on there. We'll be doing a fair amount of work over the next several months, and I think leading up to what will be the 10th anniversary of the men coming to Guantanamo in January. So you should definitely stay tuned with that. And you should also continue to read the paper and follow us and follow what we're doing. We have a number of really exciting cases that are going to be filed, I'm suspecting, in the next several months on issues of national security as well as international human rights and racial justice issues. And so it's an exciting time. So please check us out, support us, follow us, give us your thoughts on what we should be doing next.
Thank you, Vince Warren.
Vince, thanks so much.
Thanks, Vince.
Thanks, Vince.
See you
soon. Thank you all very much for having me.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org and look for us on Facebook at Law and Disorder.